Welcome to the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. We are your hosts, Martijn Bron and Alexander Sterk.
Okay, welcome for another episode. This is the 8th episode of the Strong Force Commodity Podcast. And we are extremely happy that we have as our guest today, Jan Dieleman. He is the president of Cargill Ocean Transportation. I know Jan for more than 20 years. I started slightly earlier than Jan as a trainee in Cargill in Amsterdam, where he also started as a trainee on the non-grain feed ingredients desk. And then before me, he went to Geneva. And since then, he progressed in a really impressive career. Has been a fantastic trader, but now also a true business leader and even industry-wide innovator, if I may say. So I'm very happy that we have Jan as our guest to talk about commodity markets and to talk about leadership.
Yeah, Jan, same here. Of course, I didn't work 20 years. I'm, of course, the youngest guy here in the podcast. Luckily, as I turned 39 years old yesterday, so I'm still below the 40. But no, very interesting also to see, when I was looking at trading, I always looked at products like an actual cocoa or a grain or a dairy. And now it's about something else, about transport, about something else. So I'm super interested to hear more about that from you. And all the years experience that you have will definitely bring us something interesting for listeners. So I leave it up to you to give yourself your own introduction. And then I think we will have some really cool conversations going on.
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for having me, right? I think it's a really interesting concept that you guys are putting out here. I listened to a few of the other ones and some people I know, which is really interesting to hear. And I'm sure we're going to have a nice conversation here as well. So as Martijn said, I started a long time ago in Cargill. Did many things, actually. And I think that is something that has changed over the years. When I started, you really had the opportunity to move around a lot of products, a lot of businesses, and a lot of experiences. And if I look at my career, and it's actually been 25 years this year, I've been able to do many things and many products, as you said, and also freight. And you could argue that freight is also a commodity in itself, and at least we approach it as a commodity in itself. So I've done a lot of things, and yes, I've changed a little bit over the years. I think that was what Tyne was alluding to, where I was very much focused in the beginning to be, well, trading myself. And then I became actually a manager of traders. And now I'm actually probably even more a business leader and to some extent also trying to move an industry that is undergoing a lot of change. And that is, it's a bit scary at times, but also extremely exciting at the same time. So,
hey Jan, one of the first things I'd like to know, when we worked on the trading floor in Amsterdam at the Koenhavenweg, everyone was kind of interested more in the oilseeds processing. Soybeans and rapeseeds and sunseeds and trading vegetable oil. That was what the floor was all about. How did you come to the idea to move to Geneva so quickly and then move to freight?
It's an interesting one, Martijn, because if I look back at 25 years, right, and if you would ask 100 people on the street, Cargill, what do people do? Well, first of all, a lot of people wouldn't know Cargill, I guess, right? We all know that. But people would associate you with grain trading, I would say, right? And you can argue what grain trading is exactly. But I've actually only traded grains just in the first couple of years, and that wasn't even real grains, right? So I've had a 25-year career in Cargill without really having traded grains, and you won't see that very often, I think, in this company. But no, for me, it's very simple. Early on, I think I probably had the coolest job that you could get. I was doing all this non-grain feed ingredients, which in my first year gave me a business trip to Florida, a business trip to Brazil, and also to Thailand, right? So that was the cool thing, I think, to start. And the nice thing was those were products that we were actually moving around. So we actually were in touch with the freight business very early on. Then at some point, someone came to me and said, you know what, do you want to spend a couple of weeks in Geneva? Because we think it could be interesting for you. So I took the opportunity and then I kind of rolled into freight. And I started in this parceling business that we had into Amsterdam. That was very interesting. And my idea was, I'm going to do freight for a couple of years. And it's going to make me a better trader and I'm going to go back and trade whatever commodity. The reality was I'd hit the sweet spot because this was when the whole market was deregulating on coal, deregulating on iron ore. It was growing like crazy on the back of China. And it was just a massive run where I never looked back, actually. And I stayed in trade in my first stint because I've been there twice till 2010. So that was an 8-year stint that was supposed to be only a 2-year fee. So that's kind of how I rolled into it. And then you get in touch with all kinds of other aspects.
But what is then, give us an insight about, you say you approach freight as a commodity, right? But what do you guys do as a freight traders, right? So I think I have an idea, but I think the listeners would love to hear what you basically do.
Yeah, so it's, you can probably call us a freight trader, freight operator, as they call us in more of the maritime industry terms. And what we basically do is a couple of things, and that's a little bit explaining the business model, I would say. So first of all, we are optimizers, right? We have a bunch of cargoes and a bunch of ships. And if you have that together, you can actually optimize that. So it's a big optimization game. And just to give you an idea, we have at any time 700 ships on the water. So that is a huge optimization game that you can play. So you're selling cargoes from A to B.
You don't own ships, yeah?
At the moment, we don't own. We have some structures where you're part kind of, you could argue you're owning. And if you're leasing a ship for 10 years, you kind of own it in a way. So, but technically, no. So you have all this selling voyages, taking ships on time charter, we call that, which is basically leasing. And then you start playing. And the way we started is Cargill had a big book out of South America into the rest of the world. And then we said, well, why don't we just take some of these ships ourselves and do a cargo into Brazil? And then we optimize that. So that's kind of the optimization game that we started to play. And then you can play all kinds of things like front haul, back hauls. And I'm not going to bore you with all that, but there's a lot of basis kind of trading, I would say, that you can do in that part. Then there's a hardcore kind of risk-taking piece in ours. And that's just really having a view, is freight going to go up or down? And we have a portfolio where small in tankers and clean products. We're in the main kind of bulk sizes, all the way from something we call geared, which is ships with gears on board, to Kamsarmaxes, Panamaxes, all the way to Cape sizes. And the volatility in these markets is just amazing. And it's not easy to predict, right? At some point it was easy because the only way was up when China was there taking everything that was available. And now we have different markets. But it's a very cyclical market, I would say. And as a result of that, if you're in a high cycle, the trading opportunities are normally enormous. And then also your optimization possibilities are really, really interesting. So when the stars align, this is a really, really interesting business. But if you're in the low cycle, it's actually quite tough. So for those days, what we really started to do a couple of years back is trying to add some parts of the business which are much more service oriented. And that also makes sure that you can survive somehow these lower cycles. And a good example of that is a fuel business where we are bunkering 2.5 million tons of fuel oil ourselves. And now we're actually adding about 2.5 million tons for other people and do that against the fee. And it's like giving people access to scale, quality, better prices, et cetera, et cetera. So we're trying to somehow diversify ourselves. We took a couple of investments in some startups as another kind of example in that. So we're trying to have a bit of a bigger portfolio than just having to rely only on the stars aligning on the cyclical market.
But then things, like, for example, what I then see on the news, the piracy. So that then, is that then, that creates volatility in prices, I assume then, on freight or not?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I can assume all these security people on the board, it also called extra cost, these kind of things, or is that part of your business?
Yeah, no, absolutely, right? So if you, what I like about freight is if you really want to be good in freight trading, you actually have to understand the commodities that you're shipping. So you have to understand the iron ore market. You have to understand the coal market. You have to understand the minor bulks. So you have to understand the supply side, which is what's going on in the shipyards and all these kind of things. So, and especially when you see things like the war in the Ukraine, all of a sudden you see flows changing from origins from there to Brazil, or you see wheat changing into different trade flows. And that is not just different load in a discharge port, but sometimes these voyages are double the size. And I think a good example of that is what's happened in the tanker market. In the old days, we had diesel coming from Russia into Europe. Now, basically, crude is being shipped to India and then being shipped back into Europe as diesel. So that's double the ton miles. So that is taking a lot of capacity out there. So there's all these things that we are used to disruptions. I think what we've seen lately is we have a lot of disruptions at the same time. And I have not seen that in my career so far.
Yeah,
you touched based on it without mentioning the word S&D yet, but can you shed some light on how you make an S&D? And if I look back at when we started, you know that every trader on the desk, they made their own S&D. And you know the joke from Dave Cyrus, right? Cyrus the virus. When he was always chasing everyone to submit their individual S&D. And that was fairly old school, Excel-based, and later on some kind of a model. But I can imagine the things that you just described, nowadays, you can't do it like that anymore because you're going to be too late. And also what you described clearly, you need to understand the commodities and the S&Ds of those commodities impacting freight. Could you shed some light on how you, as a company, as a business, manage that S&D?
So I think, as I said earlier, right, we approach it from a commodity aspect in essence, right? Which basically means you have to look at S&Ds. You can't trade a commodity without looking at an S&D. We are putting risk metrics on. We have VAR, we have stress, we have limits, et cetera, et cetera. So we approach it the same way. And I think we're quite sophisticated in this because in freight, there's a lot of it is not marked to market, but is marked to model because you have to make a lot of assumptions on how long a voyage, for instance, takes, right? If you sell 10 voyages, is it going to be 10 times 30 days or 10 times 40 days, right? So there's a lot of these things that you put in a model. Coming back to an S&D, I think like everyone else, we've been evolving, right? And in the beginning, we probably had an edge because we were really looking mathematically at all the commodities and started forming a view. And being bearish a commodity doesn't necessarily mean that you need to be bearish the freight, right? Because it could mean that there's actually super bullish because there's a big crop coming, right? So there's a lot of these things you have to translate into freight kind of impact. But nowadays, yes, we have an S&D that's much more medium to longer term. That's really trying to put some projections. Okay, what do we think of the iron or market growth in the next 5 years? What do we see on the shipping building side? So that's more the biggest cycles I was just talking about that we're trying to do. But now you have to also look very much into the region. So we have regional S&Ds where people really look in the, for instance, in the Black Sea, what's coming in, what's coming out. We use a lot of digital tools. We've been tracking all ships in the world for the last 10 years, I think, which we're probably one of the first to do. So there's a lot of things now that you have there. And I think one thing that is underestimated in freight, it is a commodity that you can't store, right? So there's a lot of sentiment in here as well. So on a Friday evening, if there's two ships, two cargoes, it's also sometimes who's going to blink first, right? Is it the Greek ship owner that wants to get done before the weekend, before he goes to the beach, or is he happy to wait till the Monday? So there's a lot of these kind of nuances there. And that's why I think in freight, relatively speaking, you still have a lot of human interaction versus some of the other markets. And I think it's around that.
Do you have defaults often? Because, for example, now we briefly touched base before we started the formal podcast about cocoa. Yeah, with prices of cocoa exploding, everyone is talking about, okay, what is actually your position? Because what is going to be defaulted? How is that in the freight industry?
If you look at some of the freight charts historically, you can probably see when we had some of these moves, right? If you look at 2008, 2009, I can still vividly remember that. At some point, our book, because we do, of course, measure our credit risk and stuff, we had an exposure which was like $1.5 billion on the owning side, right? And that felt relatively good because that's kind of, we call it right side risk, because when we're in the money, they're in the money because their asset is worth more. So it's less of an issue. But then within 3 weeks, we basically swifted all around and we had $1.5 billion exposure on the other side. And at that time, we got quite nervous because then you don't have right set risk anymore. Then you just have people that bought freight too early and somehow it's going to eat into the margin. And so we've had some wild rides over the years. We've had some defaults, but I think we're managing risk actually very tight. And that's also why certain businesses we just don't do. I think sometimes you just have to pass on that. I think what is good nowadays, and we'll probably end up talking a little bit about that later, is with all the uncertainty that you have in the industry, with all the uncertainty on what the decarb is going to mean, you see less and less people willing to commit for 10-year kind of COAs or contracts. And I think it's getting a little bit more short-term, which also means the credit risk aspect is actually less than it was in some of these days.
Okay, thank you. I made a note to congratulate you because you are on the 2023 Lloyd's list of 100 most influential people in shipping. Now, what they say, the ranking does not measure scale or volume. It charts the people who are influencing the direction of the industry through their successes, failures, innovations, and in some cases, sheer force of willpower. Well, that is a great compliment. Why do you think you're on that list? And do you indeed feel influential, not only in Cargill, but also to the broader industry? And if I may say so, if I look at LinkedIn, for example, I only see you, almost. Maybe that is my feed, but I find it actually quite striking to see you often, almost as a representative of the broader industry.
Yeah, I'm always a bit skeptical about rankings, right? You know, I'm from Zeeland, so I'm a little bit down to earth in those kind of things, right? So whenever I see that I'm on a list, I always translate that we as a business, and I'm just the billboard somehow of the industry, of the business that we do. So I think it's a compliment for what we do as a business. And yes, of course, I've got my role in that. I think what we've done different, and I think that's why we are on that list, is I think we've always been a huge player in the industry, right? And we still are. We're top two, top three, whatever you want to call it. 80% of what we do is non-cargo. That's sometimes things that people forget, right? More than 250 million tons of cargo. That is significant, right? 700 ships, as I said earlier. And I think what we've been trying to do is we've always said we want to be a leader, right? Everybody says that. Everybody wants to be a leader. But I was from the strong conviction early on that if you want to be a true leader, you also need to lead in the topics which are not that easy. Mm. It's easy to lead in easy stuff, right? And claim your fame. And we actually went in there and said, you know what, we're a big player. There is some issues. And the shipping business has issues, right? It has an emissions issue. 90% of world trade goes overseas. Still 3% of world emissions are there, which probably puts you at number 5 or 6 in terms of countries, somewhere between Japan and Germany. So still efficient, but it's a huge carbon footprint that somehow, if shipping doesn't decarbonize, we're just not going to get to the 1.5 degree goal. So there is something, it's a hard to abate industry. You can't just plug it into the electricity network and you're fine, right? Like some other industries can. So that's a big one. There's a big one around safety, right? It's still one of the most unsafe industries in the world. The highest chance of dying is at sea still. There's issues on labor conditions, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of things which I think the shipping industry shouldn't be too proud about. And I think what we just said, okay, let's try to make a difference. And I think using the skill that we have is actually able to do some of these things. And one of the things we did early on, and you might notice, we took a share in a company called Rightship many, many years back, and we just set minimum standards for safety. It wasn't the regulator, we went beyond, right? What we did recently is we started that Global Maritime Forum, and I just happened to be the chair after being involved with them for a couple of times, and we're really trying to move an industry on the decarb debate and say, you know what, there's no company alone that can solve this, so let's work together and let's pull our weight. And it's not just because I think it's the right thing to do, which is a strong driver for me personally. But it's also, if you're in the kind of front of these massive movements, you can see huge opportunities as well. And I think at Cargo, we're at best if there's a real step change in something. And also from a business point of view, being somehow in the lead, I think has a huge benefit. And we've seen it over the last couple of years.
That's great. And
pretty impressive.
Then how do you scale that? Huh? Because I've seen the ships with the sails, huh? The I think it's carbon sales or whatever. Now, that looks impressive, but is that something that can scale? Or do you look at, I don't know how many years in the future, do we look at ships with batteries? Or is it...
Is there already like a Tesla model of a ship?
Or LNG? Or how do you do that? Huh?
I think in there, right? I think what we try to do is somehow kickstart some of these things, right? We can't just scale things on our own. And I think what we've been trying to do is initially we focused a lot on efficiencies, right? And efficiencies is low-hanging fruit, has a payback, and we should just double down. And it's incredible, right? Some ships still get delivered from the shipyard and they don't even have LED lights, right? So there's a lot of things you can actually do there. And there's a lot of things about paints and stuff. And I can go on and on and on. And a lot of these things have a 3-4 year payback. So why are we just not doing it? So we started underwriting some of that risk and said, you know what? If you as an owner are not willing to do it, we'll pay for it and we'll get the fuel savings and we'll do it that way. And with that, some people got confident because they said, well, if Cargill is going to pay for this stuff, then they must know that this is actually working. So we started that move and that is working. And then we have biofuels. You know that we are a producer of biofuels, second generation again, et cetera, et cetera. So there was a lot of people that said, well, the engine manufacturer is not guaranteeing the safety and the warranties, et cetera, et cetera. And we just started to trial it. And we just got all kind of owners just to trial it. And we set up a business in Singapore where we're now selling a lot of biofuels also to other parts of the industry, like car carriers, container ships, et cetera, et cetera. So we took the lead and then we were able to scale it. Where you're getting a little bit more complicated is the green fuels. And ship and I would say the wind is probably a little bit in the middle. But the green fuels you're talking about, who's going to pay the extra cost? It's not anymore about the payback. It's like, who's paying for that? And then it becomes complicated. And that's where, at the moment, we need the regulator to step in, because you cannot only rely on people with voluntary kind of goals doing this. So the regulator is getting its act together. So the IMO is on a trajectory of making some significant changes, because if the regulator doesn't follow, this becomes an uninvestable industry. And we're going to be talking about the new fuel still in 3 years' time. And we probably will not have made a difference. And coming back to the wind, there's an interesting one. We've been in wind, and not many people know, but we've been in wind 15 years ago. And maybe, Martijn, you still know that we have the kites, right? And the reality is we actually lost two of the three kites. And the third one, we turned into messenger bags here for the teams here. And I made a point out of it because it was like, whenever I got here to talk about wind, everybody was getting very small and said, like, oh, it was a disaster. It didn't work. And I was like, I don't understand it. Whenever I talk to people outside, everybody says like, oh, you guys were doing this cool stuff with wind. So I was like, that's a mismatch here. So what is this? And we just decided to go back into wind, and we did it over COVID. We found the right partner, and it's just an amazing project that we got over the line. And it's kind of cool to see what publicity has actually got also very much outside the shipping industry, right? It's been on news channels far, far away from the traditional shipping outlets. And I think it's showing that the industry is changing, that there's actually things you can do. And that was a point that we wanted to make. But yeah, scaling is indeed a challenge, and there's a lot of things to be done, and we can't do it on our own, as I said earlier. And it's strange to say, but you don't hear businesses often saying we need a price on carbon, but in this case, we need a price on carbon.
Yeah. And what about in the world of freight? So I heard already interesting anecdotes, stories from people that have many years of experience in the world of commodities. So I'm very much interested, is there like a wild, interesting story of something that happened in all these years that you possibly could share with us?
Yeah, I've had the craziest things, right? And I still remember the days that we had people cleaning our ships, and instead of paying them in Thai baht, we paid them in US dollars. And I think the guy had to commit to sweep the holds for the rest of his life to pay us back. So those are some of these things that you come across. But you have the craziest stories, people switching off the AES system to go or too short to get a couple of boxes of whiskey on board and stuff. Here, the craziest things, and it's getting more complicated, right? These Wild West stories, because things are getting a lot more transparent. But I've had many, many crazy stories over the years, but it's probably good to not get them all out here.
Very good.
I would like to take the opportunity to talk about leadership, because we have had a good amount of traders in the podcast already, and we have people interested in commodities and commodity trading. But you have made it to the highest echelons of Cargill, which is one of the biggest companies in the world. It's very competitive. And I said that at the start of the podcast, the thing about Jan is he hasn't really changed since I met him. So you are very approachable. As you already see now,
what is a great compliment?
You're optimistic. You have clearly an appetite for risk. You have a certain vision, but there are more people who have that. And there are plenty of people who I know who have that also in Cargill. Now, what is it, according to you, why you have made it to the level where you are now? And in terms of advice, and that you can give to young people who have big ambitions, and especially also, and the way I describe it often, why I liked to be on the desk, the trading desk, most of my life, at a non-corporate environment. Now, you have managed to break through that and also become extremely successful in the typical corporate environment. So what kind of qualities you need to reach it to the level that you have reached?
Yeah, there is always a factor of luck, right? Being at the right place at the right time. I think you can't underestimate that. So there is always a piece of that. But I think what you said earlier, it's interesting you say that, because I hadn't reflected on that myself, but you have to be true to yourself, right? If you're not yourself, I think you're going to get caught out. If you're trying to be someone else than you are, or it doesn't work. And I think with me, what you see is what you get, to be honest. And if you're consistent, open, honest, transparent, I think that it goes a long way, right? So that's also, for me, that's how I want my brand to be. I want people to be able to walk in my office and have a chat. And because that's me, I want to be approachable. That's my style, and that suits me. And some other people might have other styles, right? And I always get the question from, who did you learn a lot? And sometimes you learn a lot from people how you don't want to be, right? Mm. And I've had a couple of managers where I was like, you know, that's not what I would like to look back on my career and say that was me. So I think that is one. So do that. I think what I've done as well, I've been very curious always, trying to do different things. At some point, I stepped out of the trading seat, and I did a kind of an IT kind of project for a while, which actually helped me to understand much more the end-to-end business. And I think that's important. You can be the best trader of the world, but if it doesn't get executed well, then I don't think you get very far. So there's certain things you have to somehow see the end to end. And I think that's what always interested me. And then I think I did some other experiences, right? I went to the energy markets for 6 years. And I tell you, from being kind of the big gorilla that Cargill in a lot of markets is, right? All of a sudden, we were the fly on the wall. And that's humbling, right? So I think that humbleness you somehow have to experience. And you make a lot of money, then you lose a lot of money, which also gives a lot of experiences. Different environment, right? From trade to all of a sudden being the US, being responsible for power and gas. And I tell you, I had no clue about how power and gas was traded in the US. And all of a sudden, you're the boss, you know, there. And so you can't rely anymore of your knowledge base and saying, I know how this works. So you have to kind of pivot. And so all these learning moments, I think, have been tremendous for me. And I think the last tip, I think, and that's what I've learned probably the last couple of years, is I think we all have the tendency to kind of assess ourselves and try to work on the things that we're not so good at. And I think we're forgetting to really make our strengths really towering strengths, because that's things that we're all good at. And I think focus on making them even better is sometimes actually even more efficient and effective than trying to do all these little things that you maybe don't do so well and you get lost in translation, I think. So I think it's a combination. Yeah, and also you have to be willing to let go, right? It was difficult from being the one doing all the trades to all of a sudden relying on somebody else to be the trader and not micromanage, right? But still be their coach, challenge. And some of these changes, yeah, they're not easy, but you have to be deliberate and take them like that.
That's really cool. And what you just said is like, you went to a new commodity, so energy and gas, new market, basically. And from times I got from listeners, I get messages and then they say, well, they also talk about, you know, switching to other kind of markets or products. How do you get up to speed quickly, or how do you get up to speed in the new market? How did you do that, basically?
In the end of the day, you have to rely on other people. You have to rely on the people in your team to tell you, to teach you. If you go to the coal market, there's no book that tells you how to be a coal trader or who's who, or if this happens, you need to be thinking about this and this. So it takes time to go in there. But I think what I've always been very good at is just to apply some of the things I had in certain experiences in some markets on others, because every market has an S&D, every market has a VAR, every market has a stress, every market has events and stuff. So there's a lot of things that we always say, well, it's a very different commodity. But if you take a couple of steps back, there's a lot of things that are actually quite similar. And a lot of times it's the nuances, the knowledges. And that's, I think, you need to be careful to not fall into the pitfall that you think that because you traded corn, you know how nat gas works, right? Because there is some of these nitty-gritty things that can be hugely important where you really need to rely on other people who've been there, done that. And you just have to rely on people. And in the beginning, it's difficult, right? So relying on different people, then also relying on different people in different cultures, it's not easy always. And it's sometimes very uncomfortable, but it's the only way to do it.
Yeah, thank you.
There's something else. One of the most interesting periods that I recall, and that you were involved in that, and we talked about the energy business. When you were in Houston, at some stage, there was what was called the breakdown of the polar vortex. Now, you wrote a report about the culture in a certain trading team. And that report was distributed among Cargill. And I read it and I was really impressed by the quality and the honesty of that report. And I sent it around to everyone in the cocoa and chocolate business at the time that we were working about, that I was working in. Could you describe, because this is also about learning, huh? And we yep. often say that you learn often more from things that don't function or that go wrong than from your successes. What did you learn from that trading environment, which is basically was the basis of that report and also led to some changes in Cargill, how we approach risk?
Yeah, it was an interesting time. And maybe to put a bit of context there. So I just moved to Houston with my family, two young kids. I think they were 2 years old at the time. And my wife got really, really sick and she actually ended up in intensive care. So that was kind of hefty at that time. Yeah. And at the same time, we managed to lose $100 million in 3 days. So at that time, I was like, okay, so the world is falling apart. What am I doing, right? And I remember still very much in those days, I took a step back and I said, okay, how am I going to get out of this? And I just told myself in the end, Jan, it's just a job. The worst that can happen is they fire you. And it was so liberating for me because I could keep a little bit more distance. I could be a lot more objective and I could make some pretty good decisions that actually, I think you make back $60, $70 million in the end of the day. But you also need to reflect. And what was a big lesson for me at that time was trust but verify. And I still have that slogan very much. Is you need to trust people. You need to give people the space. But sometimes you need to really dive in deep because in the end of the day, you're responsible. You're accountable. And this was one of the times that I did dive in, but I was diving in too deep because I still remember a conversation literally 2 days before the whole polar vortex happened. It's like, aren't we a little bit big in this location position? And it was just crazy. The VAR on that position just multiplied 20 or 30 in like 2 days. And it was like, everything happened. And then you also go back and then you come back into culture. And I think culture is extremely important in the trading business. And that business, I think what the problem was at that time is these people had been together for so long and it became kind of family. And it was, and the way they talked about it, it was not anymore. It was all friendships. And it's very difficult to hold each other accountable on performance if you're super, super close. And I think it was one of these things. There was complacency that was kind of coming in. They made a lot of money, so they knew it all. And kind of that challenging was gone. And I think for me, it was an important piece that also from then on, I was thinking much more, okay, is someone a good trader or not? But is that team actually a good functioning trading team? Do we have the right profiles in there? And nowadays, you also put the gender component in and all these kind of things. And I think it's hugely important there. And I think that was one of the lessons there, that we just got ourselves in a position where part of it was something which was, you could call it a unlucky event. But in the end of the day, there was other things that we could have done a lot better. And I think you just need to be honest, reflect, learn, and also just keep going, right? Don't just sit in a corner and say that it's all so bad. In the end of the day, you have to get yourself together and move on. And I think that's what we did. And it was an interesting time. I learned a lot, that's for sure.
And what do you look for? Talking about the team. So what do you look for in a good trader?
I think that it's changed, right? I think we are spending a lot of time here. And I think Martijn knows, and also the psychology of trading. And we're using a couple of guys that do some coaching on the desk because it is a hard job, right? It's got sometimes very high highs and sometimes very low lows. And how do you continue to function in that? And in the end of the day, you need to have a team. And that's with, I don't believe in the star trader. I believe in star trading teams. And in that, there's people which are very good, maybe in the offensive, in the risk taking. Some other people are a little bit better in saying, have we looked at it all? You have people that are impulsive, some people that want to dig a little bit further. You need those different views to get there. And especially today where I think markets are, it's not as trending, I would say, as what we've seen in certain times when commodities were just booming. In these markets, you just have to be agile. You have to be willing to also say, and I think that's probably one of the traits I see in a good trader, is also to cut a position and to say, you know what, that's yesterday, this is what I thought, but the world has changed. So I'm going to get out and not get too attached to your position, which is very easy, right? Because it's you, you put it on and da 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 da. In the end of the day, you need to have a culture where it's okay to say, I think we got it wrong. Or, you know what? Let's be honest. We don't really know what's going on. And sometimes, and I have this as well here, is you can't sit here and say the market is going to be X, Y, or Z in 2 months. That's just bullshit, to be honest with you. You cannot. You can have a view that it could be there if this and this happens or whatever, but there's no certainty. So how do you deal with uncertainties? And that's, I think, being humble, being reflective, and also just at some point just to say, you know what? I've been wrong. I'm taking it off. I'm going to take a few days off and let's try it again.
Cool. Thanks.
I think another thing on that one, and I think I listened to one of the previous podcasts, and I think it was around the scorecard of a trader is the money you make. And I think over time, there's probably some truth in that. But I believe in a difference between results and performance, right? You can have great result and not performing very well, but you've just been lucky. But you can also be very, very strong performer and you just have a market that is just not giving you the opportunity. So I think we're mixing up results and performance a lot, and we are focusing a lot on performance, and performance is really the things that you can control. So focus on the things you can control, which also means that if you make a lot of money because you're lucky, just realize that you might have been lucky.
Yeah.
What makes you happy in your job?
There's many things, right? And you've spent some time in this culture, Martijn. So I think the culture here is just the people, right? And if people leave, if you ask them what they miss, they will always say the people. So I think that's loud and clear. So people here is, if you spend so much time in an office, you better spend it with people that you can learn from, you can also have some fun with, right? I think it's an important piece as well. So it's the people is very important. I think what drives me personally as well is to come back a little bit to the impact side and also probably a little bit on what kind of legacy you want to leave behind. If I can use a big organization like this to influence and have a positive impact on some of these things out there, like decarbonization, like safety, like seafarer well-being, that is something that drives me. And people always look at big business as bad, but I think big business, if you do it well, can have a huge positive impact on society. And that's what I try to focus on. And that's what keeps me going, to be honest with you.
I think you're making a very good point. And that's also one of the drivers of this podcast, that we wanted to provide more transparency about what the impact is of the commodities industry and how it can be part of the solution and not part of the problem. Huh? And also, I think what a lot of people do not understand is that commodity traders, they don't survive in isolation. They transport and process and trade in goods that people need for eating and transportation. And that is what I think quite often underestimated, and especially by the mainstream media. The focus is often about look at how much money they make, but they forget how much risk is involved. And there are a lot of good people with good intentions. Yeah, they try to make money, but they have good intentions to make sure that people can eat. And for all the stuff that you will find in the supermarket, it has been produced somewhere and it has been shipped. So
I'm fully with you, right? And it's easy with my kids, right? They love the hamburger, but don't really want to know how the hamburger was actually produced or where it actually originated, right? That's kind of the culture that we're in. And I think during COVID, people started realizing that sofas were actually transported by real people and that there could be delays, right? And we had the horror stories of people being stuck on board for more than a year and a half, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's a transparency piece. I think what we do does matter, Martijn. I think, and that's also something that I remind people on as well. I think we are moving essential goods around the world, and it's not just food. It's also iron ore, it's energy, right? A big part of the world is still depending on coal as the primary source of energy. So there's a lot of these things, I think, that really matter. To come back on you as well, on the making money and not, it's the same discussion on the whole sustainability drive. In the end of the day, sustainable also means that it's sustainable financially, correct, right? And otherwise it becomes charity. And I always say, if it becomes charity, it's great, but at some point the pockets are going to be empty and it's going to stop. So that's not very sustainable, right? So that needs to be somehow a business model around it. And I think making money is always seen as something bad. I think it's needed for change to happen. Otherwise, it just we're not going to make any progress.
And of course, Jan, with Vespar, I'm in the world, of market intelligence, commodity intelligence. In your world, in the freight, what we're totally not active in, is that transparency of intelligence, is that there as well? And does it help you, or is in transparency for traders sometimes actually better?
Yeah, that's a good question, right? I think the world has become a lot more transparent. Data is more widely available. I think in the old days, having people on the ground gave you the edge because you heard some things earlier. Those days are gone, right? So you need to somehow move with that. So I think everybody is counting ships. Everybody is watching trade flows. That's now table stakes. And you just need to just accept that. So then you need to find your edge in something else, right? And then it's like, okay, can we discover patterns? What's our view on this coal market, right? What is iron ore? What's the steel market going to do in China? What is happening in real estate? All these kind of things, you need to really go the next step than just the basic kind of watching flows. So you have to evolve. And I think we will continue to evolve as we go. But there's also a big part is a lot of it is kind of on-demand kind of analytics, right? So see what happened today. We had a terrible accident in Baltimore, right? Where a ship is hitting that bridge. That has an impact straight away because there's big coal flows out of Baltimore. So you straight need to have the themes on, okay, so what's the impact? What does it mean? Are people going to source this coal from somewhere else? So what does that mean for freight? Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of that event-driven, I would say, analytics as well. And I think what I've seen over the years, that one is actually becoming more important, I would say.
We have a lot of young people listening. That is what I notice on comments that I either get via direct mail or via LinkedIn. They want to know, how do you get into the industry? Because the interesting thing also is the commodities industry is not as well known as, for example, other parts of finance, which is banking. People look at investment banking. Lots of talented people move to investment banking. Maybe even hedge funds is where people want to work as well, like Citadel, Point 72, you name them. But people don't often think about commodities. While I think it is a really great space to develop as a person, there's so much you learn simply also due to the combination of the physical aspect and the derivatives aspect. So you have the financial trading and you have the physical trading. Now, you already mentioned the people. Contrary to also mainstream media, and I say that often, the best traders that I know, they don't have big egos. And so the thing like the Wolf of Wall Street, I don't recognize that at all. It's very humble, smart, accessible people, no egos. Now, a great place to be, but how do you really get into that? Also, because you said early in the podcast, how do you learn to become a coal trader? you can't learn it on university. There is a curriculum now in Geneva, I know that, and there is a curriculum in Rotterdam for seniors. But what advice do you give to young people to be able to be prepared to enter the commodity industry?
Yeah, but also to add on that, why should they join the industry? Why is it so cool to be in the
commodities? That's a good one. Good one as well.
Okay, so for me, why would people join? It's pretty clear because I've spent my whole life in there and I think it's giving huge opportunities. And what we said earlier, it's an industry that also matters, right? What I really like is it's not just the paper trading or the screen clicking. It's really moving products around. And the physical aspect combined with all the trading things, I think is really interesting. It also gives a lot more opportunities as well, right? There's a lot of spreads you can trade between financial and physical, which I think a lot of people don't really grasp at times. So this is an industry which is going to be hugely important going forward. We will continue to have to move food, trade food, and the same thing, all the basic materials, right? What I like about the industry as well, it's going through a transition, right? The whole energy transition is going to put this industry upside down. If I look at freight, this has been an industry, single regulator, single fuel. Now we have multi-regulators, multiple fuels. So the complexity of this is just going to increase. And with complexity, on the one hand, you could say there's more headaches, but it's also enormous opportunity, right? So I think this industry is super cool, what is ahead of us. So sometimes I wish I could join the industry now and not 20, 25 years ago. But so I think for me, the industry is not known. I agree on that, but it's got vast opportunities and it's really changing. And I think that's really interesting. How do you join is an interesting question. I do think you have to have somehow a passion for or a curiosity in this area. If you don't have that, you don't have the passion, you don't have the curiosity, like any other industry, it's going to be difficult to be successful. I'm very much of the camp that you need to follow your passion, you need to follow your interest, and not just what the highest offer is on the job market, right? So I think you need to be really invested yourself there. So I think that's one thing that you have to do. And then again, you have to be curious, right? See what kind of commodities you like, because iron ore is very different than cocoa, for instance, right? So, and there's a lot of differences there. And I think there's a lot of things you can do. We have the traction and we are in contact, of course, with all these educational pieces to see how we can get some talents from them. But we also have our own talent screening days and we have people which are from completely different industries that show interest. And what we really test them on is are people agile? Are they curious? Are they quick learners? The commodity aspect you can learn as you go. So we're really looking more at the traits of people than the knowledge, because I think knowledge you can get nowadays quite quickly.
In terms of examples that you have, before we go there, let me go to some of that I have. And a guy like Paul Tudor Jones, for example, I've always admired him. Paul Tudor Jones, founder of his own hedge fund and well known from the late 80s movie that was made about him called Trader. I think it's absolutely fantastic movie that I recommend to everyone. But also, for example, a guy that you know, Ivo Sojanovic, who I worked with in Geneva. Now, he wrote a book now, and that is a typical guy where I think, wow, this is such an example of no ego, but extremely talented, respected by everyone in the industry, being a fantastic trader, leader. What are the people that you admire?
Yeah, that's a good one. I thought a little bit about that earlier, and I think it's difficult to put just names. If you can imagine 25 years in Cargill, I've seen some really, really strong people passing by and everybody was slightly different, right? And I do think what makes a successful power trader is also very different than someone trading beans and knowing how that whole system works. It's different trading styles. So I don't think there's one style fits all, but in the energy space, I've come across some really, really strong people. I think in all respect, the energy trading is probably a couple of steps ahead of the agri commodity trading, I would say. And that was for me really an eye-opener to see some of these people thinking ahead, right? So I'll give you an example. We had a weatherman in Texas, right? And he wasn't predicting the weather. He was predicting what the weather forecast was going to be, right? And because that was driving the market. And I was just sitting there, I was like, this is the coolest thing. This is, you're not predicting the weather, but just predicting what the market is going to be told, what the weather is going to be. That's actually the driver, not the weather itself. Who cares? It's what the market sees, right? So it's those things that you really learn from people. And then, of course, I've had a few people in my career which really stood out and gave me the trust and gave me the space to grow. And I think, of course, you respect those people very much because they, in the end, make or break your career and you owe these people a lot. And it's funny because a lot of these people you're still in touch with, right? And some of them are well retired and it's great to keep that conversation going. So for me, it's a mix. And I've seen some of the people which they were just like oracles, right? And you know, some of them, if they stood up in the meeting room, you were like, wow. times have changed. And I think that style of those days doesn't fit the current environment anymore. So I think the better traders that I've seen are the ones that actually are able to evolve, I think, and not just have a one style and embrace new things, embrace new technologies, embrace new ways of working. And that's not easy, right? Because we all have a default and we all have our habits. But being able to continue to evolve, I think those are the people I really admire.
Pretty amazing. If you look at, you know, that you've been in different industries, and I, and also for you, Martijn, I mean, you have been in different industries from the oil seeds, et cetera, and to the cocoa. If you look at all these industries, is there like an industry that you guys like, oof, you know, that's what I didn't touch that one, but actually I heard only cool stories about it, that it's interesting, that it's nice, that it's exciting, that it's, which one is that for listeners? If you start in, then maybe that's maybe the one to go.
If I say watch this space, I think it's, again, look what's happening around us. The world has to go through an energy transition. That's going to be a massive new industry. We're going to be stop moving certain goods. We're going to be moving completely other goods over the next 10, 15, 20 years. There's a huge opportunity in that space, in the bioenergy space, in the zero carbon fuel space, the methanols, ammonias. Those are all new things that are coming, right? You can put carbon in there and all that. So I think that space is going to really grow really, really fast. It's complex. It's still quite regional. So I think the opportunities are tremendous. And that's also within freight. That's one of the things that excites me to really see that change. Because what is also an interesting part of that, if you translate it to freight, is we always have the problem. We end up talking to the procurement department. And if you talk to the procurement department, the discussion is pretty singular. You can talk about what you want, but they all need to beat the index that they've gotten as their performance measure. And if they beat it by 50 cents, it's okay. So you always talk about price. Now you go through this whole decarbonization story. It's not anymore around the 50 cents. It's around how we're going to get to our goals. How are we going to position our business? What does it mean for our business model in the next couple of years? So we end up talking a lot more to CEOs of companies, to marketing sites, to sustainability leads. And the discussions you have with those people are a lot more enriching, I have to say personally, than about if something has to be 25 cents cheaper or not, right? So I think with that whole drive for the decarbonization that is coming, that whole energy transition that we're going to go through, and it's going to be tremendous opportunity. And that's clearly a space that I would recommend people to keep an eye on.
Amazing.
Complexity gives opportunity, eh? Is what we always say in Cargill.
Exactly.
Very good. Looking at the time.
On that note,
Jan, I learned something about the world of freight, what I had no clue about, but I also really enjoyed the energy that you give into this podcast and where you have become in your career. I mean, it's really, really impressive. And I think a lot of people have this ambition to get to where you are. I want to thank you very much for your time, for your honest answers, but also Martijn. I think this, yeah, I really enjoyed it. I don't know how you look at this podcast, looking at your old colleagues.
It was fantastic because what you see here is it's not only a trader, but like I said, it's a leader with a vision, which is who is able to get not only people in Cargill behind him, but also in the industry. And we also touched base on, you know, how you recover from setbacks, even if it's a combination from personal and professional. That's, I think, very inspiring for many people. And that is also what I explain to people who want to come into this industry. There is so much that you learn from being a commodity trader or merchant that you can apply to your private life. There is always a solution. You will always be able to bounce back when you trust your judgment. Now, and Jan's optimism is very clear.
Trust by verify.
Trust by verify.
And also the sentence, high highs and low lows. I really liked Jan, because I think that's with trading. When I was trading, you had these days that were super active, and then it could be a week that you're like, and then I was told my wife's like, yeah, now we had a quiet week. It's like, but then, it's the market. Like something you can always like in just by yourself get active or so. It's just, yeah, I'm trying to call everybody, but nothing is happening. It's a dead market. And that's what your high highs, low lows. I mean, yeah, you have that as well, these experiences. It's part of commodity trading, of the world of commodities. But I think when it's there, you have to be that person that is immediately on. You have to be active. You have to be especially ready for that moment when it's there.
Yeah, so I'm sure you will be inspiring many young people, if not also older people, but a lot of young people who have been thinking about the commodity industry and now think, yes, that's what I'm going to do. So thanks a lot, Jan.
Yeah, and overall, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure to give a bit of an insight in a complex world, right? And a world that is not very well known. One thing I would leave the people with is when you're thinking about trading commodities, don't exclude trade.
Definitely not. Yeah.
Thanks, Jan. Thanks very much.
Have a great day, Jan.
Bye, Jan.